A little idle chatter about the people that we know. And though it doesn't matter, is there a different way of saying hello?
You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit www.questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Good morning and welcome to The View. I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford here in Austin, Texas, and I'd like for our regulars to introduce themselves and say a little bit about what is going on in their world. And first, Aisha, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser and I'm in Seattle, Washington. And well, we had for our white supremacy teaching, Dr. Robin DiAngelo. She came and did the service on Sunday. So that was amazing and exciting. And hopefully when we get going, I'd love to hear what how all of your teachings went or if you have yet to do them. So that's me. I'm feeling good. Feeling good.
Excellent. And this is Michael Tino here in beautiful Peekskill, New York. And for those who don't know, Dr. Robin DiAngelo invented the term white fragility. She's been a guest on The View, and she'll be presenting several workshops at GA in New Orleans, and I'm really looking forward to hearing what she has to say. It's a busy end of the church year time here in New York. Our teach-in itself is actually going to be May 21st. Our religious exploration ministry team decided that they would like the teach-in to be held on RE Sunday because they want RE Sunday to be teaching people. So we're really looking forward to that. And this past Sunday, we had a guest preacher who actually talked about the history of white supremacy in Unitarian Universalism to set up some of our teach-in stuff. So that's exciting. And things are happening here. And it's a busy time of year. And it's good.
Well, hi, everyone. I'm Terry Bernard running tech today. I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota, where it's gardening season. I'm so happy to be in my garden. I feel like I announce that every week, but it's because it fills me with such joy. And, you know, it kind of makes Meg Riley seem like she's here because we all can imagine that she's probably spending her sabbatical almost 24/7 outside of social justice work inside of her garden. And then, you know, the teach-in, my home congregation is Unity Church Unitarian in St. Paul. And we did our teach-in as a weekday event. So there was one that took place on a Wednesday evening and then one that took place just a couple days later on Saturday. And they were meant to actually where you could go to both of them. So the Wednesday night, we ended up having almost a full sanctuary. There were several hundred people that were there. It was amazing. It was so cool. And they did kind of laying the groundwork, really doing an introduction with an interspersing of singing and then educational and then some group sharing time and then some testimony where we walked around the sanctuary with microphones. And then I wasn't able to go to the Saturday event, but the idea behind that one was to kind of briefly cover what we talked about in Wednesday, but have way more time for people to go deeper and talk directly amongst themselves. And by all accounts, it was just blew the ministers and the organizers away with how many people came. So it was really, really exciting. So I'm going to be live tweeting and I'm going to be behind the curtain, so to speak, here on the episode, but I'm looking forward to having Michael Crumpler on the show.
Let me go ahead and introduce our guest, Michael Crumpler, who is LGBTQ and Intercultural Programs Manager.
At the UUA, it should be said.
Oh, welcome, welcome. And while we're figuring out that tech issue, I will give you an update from Texas. We had our teach-in this past Sunday, went really well. I've already had someone come to me and ask for some continuing work, and she may be heading it up, so glad to hear that. And y'all, Texas. Okay, so Texas legislature is only in office for about 6 months every other year. But man, during the time when they're in office, like it is draining us. Oh, still having some sound issues there. So it's May and they're supposed to end on May 29th. And so like 600 bills have come to the floor, and I swear 50% of them, the whole purpose is to attack the LGBTQ community. And they should be ending on May 29th, but they're already talking about going into special session. And so all the Texas liberals right now are just like, I don't think I can make it. I think I'm just going to just like a Ford, you know, just die on the side of the road. So we're just trying to pace ourselves right now.
Yes. So I'm ready if you can hear me. Excellent. Excellent. I think there was a second browser open on my desktop in secret. I didn't know. And so I was hearing two people talk. So anyway, it's a pleasure to be with you. I am, as mentioned earlier, Michael Crumpler, LGBTQ and Intercultural Programs Manager. I'm really, really excited to be on The View. I cannot wait for Whoopi to join us. So what I do at the UUA is I oversee or am responsible for or work alongside of folks who are doing LGBTQ work and intercultural work and within multicultural growth and witness. And the largest part of that is overseeing the Welcoming Congregations program, which has been which has actually been in place for quite some time now, as well as working with ways to communicate and build relationships around LGBTQ issues, and then being of support on the staff group of Multicultural Growth and Witness, Finding Our Way Home, later on in the year, Mosaic, as well as figuring out how within the UUA national office to engage white supremacy within the UUA, and then how that works in congregations. So those are a few things.
Whole lot of intersectionality, it sounds like.
Exactly.
So what do you think is kind of the biggest issue that you're seeing congregations struggling with right now?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think the term itself, white supremacy, has been a term that has been an othering term, I think, in liberal progressive circles. Most people who are using it have been using it to other others. And so to have it ricochet or boomerang, you know, back at you, the very language that you use, is disconcerting, to say the least. I just don't think that people are used to that. It's almost like the old, you know, like it's like whenever you point the finger at someone else, you have three fingers pointing back at you. And I just think there's a lot of discomfort associated with using language that, as a tradition and as a culture, and people have prided themselves in being able to use and being somehow made to feel like they were in solidarity in a way that was okay and that was validating enough. And then to all of a sudden realize that that has not been received in kind by folks who you thought you were in agreement with can be difficult, and we don't have the language to pastor that. I spoke at gave a sermon this past Sunday at a UU church, and I say church because they're UUCC Disciples Church combined, so it's a interdenominational congregation. And one of my points in the sermon was that we just don't have the pastoral skills and techniques for pastoring people's white supremacy. We know how to baptize you. We know how to sit alongside of you. We know how to provide palliative care if you're suffering and sick. We know how to offer the elements. We know how to do a lot of things. But pastoring white supremacy and confronting people along those lines and how to journey with people in that process is not something that has been provided in seminary and in CPE programs and in internships. It is just not a language that, we don't have a love language for that yet. And protesting and marching and those things that's not it. I can march with you, but I can't, you know, so anyway, that's, it's
Michael, I want to jump in because the UUA headquarters hosted a teach-in. So I would love, if you can, to say what that was like for you, what it was like for staff, because one of the, I think, I'm going to name it as a misconception. People felt that there was an attack on the UUA, and that was never the intention. It was accountability is not the same as attack. So I was so inspired and hopeful when both the UUA board and UUA staff announced they will be taking part in the teach-in. And that's what this is about, right? Grappling together. So I'd love to hear how the UUA, the Unitarian Universalist Association teach-in went.
What I loved about the teach-in was it started off by reframing who the UUA is. I think that there has been, and I say this as someone who's not traditionally UU, I'm UCC, and before that, Reformed, and before that, Evangelical, and before that, Missionary Baptist. So I am new to this tradition, but as you can tell, I'm a tradition, you know, time warp traveler. So what I really appreciated at the beginning was the naming of who the UUA is, right? Because I was under the impression that when it was originally framed, white supremacy in the UUA, that it meant the local office in Boston. And that the local office in Boston was somehow separate from the lived experience and congregations around. And so I was like, wait, there's white supremacy where I work, like in my space. And they reframed it as like, when we say the UUA, we mean Unitarian Universalism writ large as a system, as a tradition. So that was very helpful, right? Because all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, I got plenty to say about that. Like I got plenty to say about broader white supremacy and not to take any attention away from the particulars and the specific actions of people that seem to perpetuate white supremacy. So that was the first thing that was good. The second thing was so many people there. And I think that the fact that people were willing to take time out and again, I don't know how, you never know how voluntary that is, right? It's like, no one wants to be the white person not going to the white supremacy teach-in, you know? So anyway, but just on its face, like the number of people who were there was great. What I was somewhat uncomfortable with, and I'll name this, was community change being brought in to do it. I felt like there was even leaving the space, and I actually flew into Boston that morning just to be present rather than to be online, because I just anticipated there being a different feeling. So I flew in just for the day and flew back out that evening. But what I just feel like the temperature in the room still was a little out of pace with the temperature elsewhere that Blue and, Kenny and Asia and different folks have been. I just felt like I still have not experienced the urgency, because there was information and education, and there was explanation of terms. And I think that there's a place for that. But I also think that that plays into white supremacy sometimes too, when you make it an academic discussion rather than a lived experience discussion, where people are able to literally say what's happening and how they feel. Of course, you don't want to, that's tricky as well, but it was very academic. And I think that plays into the way privilege operates and how information, it makes it easier to swallow, but yet it still misses the mark.
How would you like to see us move forward with that discussion?
Probably just more time from the people, more opportunities for I should say non-professional race workers to talk about how it impacts them in their experience. Like I was at the men's lecture a series a few weeks ago in Boston, right after a lot of this hit. And someone in the UU church, that I can't think of the name of it, but just outside of Harvard there, where the second session was, one of their employees of the church was a person of color who was in the space. And she talked about what it feels like to be a Black woman working at that church. And it hit, you know, and it landed really, really well. And it was just during the Q&A session after Rosemary Knapp and Dee Dee Delgado had spoken, and she addressed them, and she let people know, like, what it feels like. I love you. And it was done in love, but, and even if it wasn't, well, anyway, that's another thing. It was done in love.
I think moments like that have way more chance of opening a space for transformation than the intellectual academic, right?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, but again, that being said, I think that any step is forward.
Michael, how do you think this impacts your work with faith and queerness? What do you see, if any, the intersectionality between white supremacy, faith, and queerness?
I'm smiling because this is my schoolhouse. This is where I get all like,
preach, Michael.
Well, I think that there is, obviously, we're all people who identify as queer are kind of caught up in a culture of homophobia. I believe right now the moment that we're in is where it's a passive homophobia. It's not an active homophobia per se. I think that it is becoming less and less cool to not be on the queer train, you know. And even if you don't understand it, you have to pretend to be on it. But the problem becomes is that, like, if you have undiagnosed white supremacy, even in queer communities, you don't understand how your behavior in the LGBT community or in a liberal progressive context is still hurting queer people of color. So it becomes an issue where folks think that that their queer experience somehow provides them with a point of entry into understanding race, when you don't understand that you're not even in the same galaxy as queer people of color. And even in a community, a tradition such as Unitarian Universalism, the privilege is so far beyond what other LGBTQ and queer people are experiencing. There's just such a disconnect there. And so I really think that in order to really understand how white supremacy operates in liberal progressive spaces, you have to understand that being in a liberal progressive space is a place of privilege, and that folks don't even get to use the word faith and queerness in the same sentence in other places. The fact that you can actually even pray, the fact that you can actually even engage in a religious experience as a queer person is a privilege. And that we enjoy a privilege of even the fact that we even get to like point to someone and say, this is white supremacy, and still keep your job or still be is privilege. And that's not to shame anyone. That's just to name it. And that's where I come into a situation like this, like, oh my God, you know, how can I help the Kiki scene? How can we reach out to, how can we name bisexuality as a lived experience? And people are, it's just a shifting conversation. So.
Well, just not having to be in the situation where you have to fly under the radar is a privilege, mm-hmm. right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And you get to be unhappy out loud is a privilege that I think is not really understood in our midst.
Michael, what has surprised you in the work coming into a UU setting, and what were you what did you not expect? What do you feel like your calling is right now? What's the top three on your to-do list? Your wow. wish list to do to fix?
Well, number one is to build relationships. I think that it's so important to build relationships. I think that the Unitarian Universalism is a very closed system that thinks it's opened.
Hold on, let me stop you just for a second. Can you kind of define that? Like closed system versus open system?
An open system is a system where people are able to move freely in and out of it without losing, without a breakdown in relationship, as I understand it, or without necessarily feeling foreign when they're beyond it. That's an open relationship. You're able to move, you're able to name the intersections, and it doesn't undermine your standing nor break relationship with people in the system. A closed system is a system that the boundary defines, the boundary itself that surrounds the system defines your relationship to it. So that you have to say, I'm a lifelong you. And then after you go beyond that, then determines whether or not what you're about to say is valid. Or if it has to be, if that becomes the point of entry where, and then obviously location. When language and terminology is so privileged around like how, you know, like, I mean, and I think that these things are good. Gender pronouns, I'm obviously all for LGBTQ and intercultural congregation versus church. Terminology is huge. And it's almost like you need to be given a dictionary in order to be able to communicate something. I made a reference to, I was in a working group, and I made a reference to the fact that I had a drink because I was trying to lose weight. And then there was like a hold it, like, I would rather not there be talk about weight because that's oppressive. And so there was like, I was like, oh, okay, I'd rather not talk about it either, so I apologize. So there's certain languages, terminology that's being used, and you will be stopped mid-sentence if you do not have that language right when you didn't even really know what the language was before you started talking. So that's something that I experience as something that defines a closed system. But there are other ways too. I think that the UU is a very open place. There's a lot of things, a lot of decisions that happen that are beyond policy, or there's not a necessary policy for. It's just like if somebody wants to do it, you can do it. And if no one wants to do it, then we won't do it, and we'll sunset a program. And I think that those things are good. That's great liberal progressive ideology or ways of being. But what happens in a situation where there's white supremacy operating, who then feels most comfortable making those decisions? And who then feels most silenced when they don't agree with those decisions? Those are little things that I notice coming into this space that go unchecked.
Well, and Michael, you've crystallized for me just in the last few minutes so many of the things that I've been hearing, especially through this white supremacy teach-in, but for, let's be clear, my entire time being a Unitarian Universalist, being in relationship with people of color in my faith, that that the closed nature of that system reinforces the white supremacy culture. And that so many folks I know and the stories that I hear from Unitarian Universalists of color have to do with the fact that if they don't feel comfortable in a local congregation because of whatever's going on in that local congregation, they've lost relationship with a faith movement that is life-saving.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And I bring up the men's lectures because Rosemary McNatt and I think it's Dr. Mark
Morrison Reed,
they provided a different frame of reference for what Unitarian Universalism is, and they connected it with their heritage and with their lived experience in a way that wasn't like, I'm black over here and I'm UU over here and I can't. And so that the narrative that they created in that space was powerful in helping that. And they actually took responsibility and claimed authority in their tradition rather than conceding that authority beyond their cultural context.
So I wonder if I can throw in one other little element in this. Are you seeing generational differences?
So that, if we could go back to what happened on Tuesday in Boston, that is probably my biggest critique, in that I experienced the pushback on white supremacy, not just in the UU, not just in the UUA, but in universities and in Ferguson and in, you know, Baton Rouge and in different places as a groundswell that is primarily that is youth, that is youth inspired, youth led, because it comes out of a context where it's hurting the most, you know, the most vulnerable. And so a lot of the languaging around Black Lives Matter comes from underneath, you know, if you will. And so, yes, there is a generational context. So I'm not sure how helpful it was to have folks who are from a earlier generation, if you will, come in and talk to us about white supremacy without the fire that has been coming from the streets since 2014. And even really not even really mentioning it much.
Interesting. So in terms of your work, in terms of faith and queerness, what would you say? So here's a question I have, because I never understood why welcoming congregations was called that. Because when I first heard the term, I thought it applied to everything. And then it was like, no, it is a, you know, some kind of certification for welcoming LGBTQ, which is great. And I'm like, so you're not welcoming other people? Like, it's a weird phrasing for me. So did you have the same reaction? Or I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I was like, why would you call welcoming congregation only apply to one group of people? Like, it seems,
yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, because I think it's a part of like that thing. It's again, we don't really understand people, especially in the LGBTQ type context. It's like, if you're queer, and I use those terms interchangeably, if you're queer, that does not at all speak to your Blackness, when that's not true. Because my queer experience is very much informed by my Blackness, homophobia in the conservative fundamental church, coming from a family that is hashtag very Black, and figuring out how to navigate that, economics, all of those things inform my queerness. But I think that in places of privilege, the UUA or whiteness nationally, people are white regardless. And that becomes the thing that is most dominant. And then they become divided by sexuality. But the whiteness is privilege, is dominant. So when people say welcoming, the assumption is that we're all white. The reason why you're not being welcomed is because you're gay. When queer people of color don't know. I don't know when I'm in an unfriendly space if it's because I'm gay or if it's because I'm Black. And so I just don't know why I'm getting shady. So I have to figure that out. And so it's less painful for me to assume that it's homophobia.
So I have a question. So if you walk into a welcoming, a congregation that has deemed itself welcoming, went through got the certificate. So the shade you're getting is going to be because you're Black. But that, you know, because it's like, look, they got the whole welcoming thing, right?
Yeah. So that's what I would have to assume if I am spiritually fit enough to deal with that. Right. If I have done the internalized work to know who I am, irrespective of who you say that I am or who you think that I am, who you perceive me to be. But because, again, we go back to the beginning where there's a tool shortage on how to provide pastoral care and the language and all those kinds of things. It's like, you know what? I really can't. I don't have anywhere to go. Like, this is the only, I don't have any other space to worship. If I start talking to you about race, I'm going to have to leave. So in order for me to stay present with you, I'm going to have to make an assumption. I'm going to make an assumption about why you're treating me this way. And I'd rather, you're more comfortable with me calling you on your homophobia than you are with me calling you on your racism. So let's just pretend that it's about queerness or homophobia or transphobia or genderphobia. And then we can talk about that because we have the language, we have the resources, we're ready. But we're not really ready. You're not really ready for me to tell you that you're hurting me because I'm not white.
Well, and you know, it's difficult to separate these things, right?
Mm-hmm.
A congregation or an organization, an institution that's steeped in white supremacy culture might be able to deal with my queerness, and they might not be able to deal with your queerness.
Exactly.
Yeah, that has to do with race, but it also has to do with queerness.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and they're connected to one another.
It is, and the and and even coming out, the whole idea of coming out and the whole idea of has that languaging come from a white context? You know, coming out is not something that queer people of color, it didn't originate with us because there's a whole other point of reference. It's just like how DL, the phrase DL, is unique to queer people of color. We know what that means. That is experience. And coming out is a whole nother experience that comes out of a different social and cultural context.
Yeah.
Because go ahead, I'm sorry.
I've never heard SGL used in a white space.
Yeah. So, same gender love. Yeah. So, excellent.
Interested in learning a little more about you. One of the things you said was on the top of your list is forming relationships. All right, so we don't know each other yet.
Yes.
And so, you have mentioned some really fascinating little tidbits about your journey. So could you introduce yourself to our viewers and to me?
Sure. So I was born and raised in North Carolina. I in like rural North Carolina, not, you know, like way down southeastern North Carolina between Raleigh and Wilmington, where there's just not much but tobacco and corn and soybeans. So I grew up in that context with my family that's really large. But we were, we traveled back and forth between North Carolina and New Jersey. And when I was in junior high school, we moved permanently to New Jersey. And so I have this weird hybrid of ultra rural as well as ultra urban. So, you know, right outside of New York City, Bergen County, I graduated from Mahwah High School. Mahwah is a upper middle class suburb of New York City, right on the borderline of New Jersey and New York State. My graduating class was 130, predominantly white, with 5 black or people of color who graduated. And Northern racism was something that I experienced, but didn't know how to name it because it was the North and it looked different. So I then graduated high school and joined the Air Force, where I served for 4 years active duty and 6 years reserve. So really 8 years reserve, because I was going to become a chaplain. So I did an extension training, chose not to do that. But most of my Air Force experience had a lot to do with not knowing who I was as a gay man, not knowing who I was as a black man, not knowing what I wanted to be professionally, but knowing that I was smart enough not to do nothing. So joining the military was a way of doing something that kind of at the time seemed like to take care of everything. It gave me the respect that I wanted. It gave me the mobility that I wanted. It gave me the closet that I wanted. So for my 20s, basically, I lived in a closet for the most part. Soon after joining the Air Force, Air Force is very receptive to evangelicalism. So I, converted to evangelicalism from just general Baptist Christian and became just this impassioned, you know, Jesus boy. It seemed to solve all of my questions. It took sex off the table so that not only did I not have to worry about not being gay, I didn't have to talk about sex at all because no one really did. So it seemed like a good fit for me at work. I immediately became, it became apparent right away that I was gifted around things of God and religion and faith and even politics and social ethics. And I loved it and I enjoyed it. So I went to Bible college at Moody Bible Institute in Chicago. And where I, in Chicago, outside of the Air Force, became a lot more triggered, if you will, by sexuality and wanting to, like, you know, express myself sexually and wanted to understand more like how this integrates with faith, what it means for my faith. It became apparent right away it became apparent long before I was able to name it, that being gay and being Christian were just, you know, mutually exclusive, that you just don't there's no language for it. It's sin. And so, so I got married and assumed that God's will for my life was to be a heterosexual man, and that these things were all in my head, and I had to make decisions through things and not follow what my body wants. And those two are separate. So all that to say, I ended up, that didn't work. So after a 7-year marriage, I got a divorce, came out, and really had a very traumatic coming out experience, where I named kind of out loud to family and friends and church and state and anybody else who needed to know that I was gay and HIV positive and about to be divorced and leaving the church. So all of those things kind of propelled me out into the queer community, the gay community in Chicago at the time. And it was painful, and there was a lot of trauma. And to make a long story short, I eventually just decided that, you know what, I need God again, or maybe at least give God a chance from the back left pew, like literally, like, come on. So there was a nearby church to where I was living at the time that had a gay pride flag posted saying all are welcomed here, and it was a UCC church. So I went in, and it just, from the moment that I walked through the door, I felt like I was home. I knew that I was in the right place. I was treated with dignity and respect. It was Christian enough for it to not freak me out as if I was going into a whole nother faith system, but it was queer enough to make me, I saw myself in the people who were involved in the liturgy, you know, who was, you know, serving as usher, who was collecting the offering, who was preaching. I saw myself, and I was able to kind of mirror what I saw in myself and in other people. And I eventually decided that I want to finish seminary. I had dropped out back when I got divorced. And so I applied to several schools, and I came to Union to go to New York. So I literally, only thing I knew about Union was that Cornel West was there, but I was so out of the loop on social justice that I didn't even realize who the big players were in social justice circles, like Cornel West and James Cone and I don't know, Audre Lorde and just all these names that I just did, that I had read about as I was reading the history of Union, but I just didn't even realize what I was doing. I was just like, seminary in New York sounds like the place for me. And when I arrived, I realized that I kind of had stepped into a gold mine around for me, for understanding who I was. And here I am. I am about, I'm a month away from being ordained in the UCC. And I found my way to the UUA really through a friend. I was applying, I cast a broad net as I was seeking a calling. I had thought that I wanted to be a chaplain, but I think I was moving in that route so that I can avoid being rejected by a church if I, you know, and not knowing why, like, wait, are you hiring? Is it because I'm black? Is it because I'm gay? Is it because I have a big mouth? Like, I don't understand. So I was going to chaplaincy is where I need to be, you know. And then as I was looking for positions, the faith-based LGBTQ scene became the organizations that were calling me back after they looked at my, so those, and those were the most fruitful interviews and seemed to resonate with me the most. And a good friend who turned me down for a position at his organization introduced me to Janice Marie Johnson, who many had known was looking for the right fit for this position.
Michael, I'm curious, and forgive me for the simplicity of this question, but I would love to know your thoughts. The United Church of Christ is kind of like our distant cousin, right? To you Unitarians, would you say, where are they on the, like, how undiagnosed is their white supremacy? Like, do you think they're more or less on the spectrum of self-awareness of white supremacy?
My impression with the UCC is that they are well aware of their white supremacy, and I think that. But the issue is, as has been with most institutions, that they recognize that there is white supremacy and we don't know what to do with it. So you go to your Black church, I'll go to my white church, and we'll come together in February. And I think that, so there's this, the UCC in most regions, or, you know, what we call associations, which are, you know, the local, there's Black churches and there are white churches within the same association. There's just not this, the UUA did not do that with race. What I perceive, again, and I'm guessing, right, because I haven't read a lot of UU history around, real history around race, because I don't know if it exists. But, like, I just think that, like, the difference is the UUA thought that it would be more racist to split, to have white churches and Black churches. And so there was this idea is that we get you, we understand, and so let's just all stay together and worship alongside one another. Whereas the UCC, again, my impression coming in is, and I'm speaking very loosely, that there are Black churches and there are white churches. And there are some that are mixed, but those that are mixed are white churches that are more tolerant of non-whiteness. So they just aren't, you know, like, they don't understand why we're having this moment. And it becomes a very scary thing, because will the UUA split? Will it not? I personally think that it won't, because I just think that I think that there's a lot of good things in the tradition that kind of make it impossible for it to split. That also makes it impossible for it to change. So it's interesting, but that would be the difference there.
Do you support creating an all Black UU church, like a brick and mortar?
Yes. Yes, yeah, I do.
That was one of what, when Jeremiah Wright was all over the news, that was my question, was where is our Trinity, you know, forget the Trinity part, mm-hmm, but, yeah. You know, and so I am curious about how this has overall affected the UCC.
Soon after Peter resigned, I attended Justin Memorial Church here in New York City. And soon after, and I'm the moderator there. And so soon after Peter resigned, during our Joys of Concerns, I basically announced what had happened as just, you know, a concern, you know, and not just a concern for the UUA, but really a concern for white liberal progressive institutions in general. I think that it is it's the beginning of a movement, right? Because you have all these churches with Black Lives Matter banners and street signs and buttons and safety pins and all these pacifiers. I just don't know if what we call the children are, like, they just have no tolerance for the hypocrisy, and they have no interest in making people feel good about what is hurting them. While the situation in the UUA comes from a privileged situation where a person didn't get a job, I would say in most communities, it's because someone's died. Someone got killed. And I think that a lot of other traditions are closer or more closely situated in those contexts of poverty. And in those contexts of suffering, that makes those churches much more vulnerable. Whereas the UUA is so far from marginalized communities, at least in thought and in experience, that when we say white supremacy, it means something less urgent than when in Harlem or the Bronx you say white supremacy. So I think that that's the difference between the UUA has situated itself in a very, very, very privileged class, upper class situation that makes the conversation a lot safer than in a Baptist tradition or a Methodist tradition or in a, you know, UCC, which is close to UUA, but there are a lot of UCC churches, you know, there are a lot of small UCC churches even right here in Harlem.
In amidst all of the work that UU congregations hopefully are going to be doing about white supremacy, the pastoral care needs are still there, as you mentioned, and we don't really have anything for that. What are the, you know, when the Black queer individual walks into the church and is trying to figure out how do I integrate this all with my faith journey, what can we do?
Wow. Listen, come back the next Sunday. Well, I'll go back with a story. So I mentioned that I'm a moderator at Judson Memorial Church. And I'm not sure how that happened. I think that there was, you know, there's a small pool of people who were available and a small pool of people who were willing. And, you know, those are how things happen. And anyway, I bring that up because you have to empower silenced voices, even if what they're saying and how they're saying it and what they're doing and how they're doing it is uncomfortable, because it's authentic, though. And it's true. And it's not directed at you. It's about you, but it's not at you. No one's going to take away your pension, and no one's going to take away, you know, the college fund for your kids, and no one's going to, I don't want to do your work. But you have to make people feel human and feel seen. And I think that the pastoral care has to do with connecting people's pain and privileging the lived experiences of people who are just living to be alive, just struggling to be alive. And in the UUA, I think honoring that there are people of color who have been here for years, not that are at the door trying to come in like me. Like, there are people who have been here for years who know the tradition, who know the system, who understand how it works, who have been advocating for the systems, even amongst their own people. That's another thing that doesn't get named. Black and brown people go back to our communities and brag about the love and the friendships that we have in white liberal spaces. When we're asked, why you go there, or why are you, or I don't understand, I can't with them. We go back and we advocate for these traditions in a way, and then we come back into the traditions and we still get diminished. But it's just a weird dynamic. We are your biggest ambassadors in the world around who you are and what you can be and what it's like to be beside you.
One thing in terms of this, of people coming forward with their heartbreak and everything else, is I think that we often will talk about making a space for grief, and we forget that anger is one of those stages of grief too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how do mm-hmm. we make a, how do we make a space for that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, and there is, and it has to be, and but a lot of what I experience is that I'm pretending to be a little more angry than I am, because you won't hear anything else. Like, I'm really not as mad as I look, but I'm just trying to get your attention. It's just like when you're about to cross the street and your mother says, scream, stop. You know, she's not angry at you, but it feels angry because that's the only way to get you to stop, so that you don't run over by a car. So I think that it's also a fun, there's a lot of laughter and a lot of smiling. And yes, I'm angry, but I'm cool because this is not the first time I've been angry about race.
It may be the first time for someone to hear it, but it's not the first
time. Exactly. It's not the first time. Like, we've been saying this all along. I've been writing it in papers. This is not, we know what we're talking about. This is just the first time I've been honest with you about it.
Right, exactly. Gosh, I'm appreciating so much of what you're saying, Michael. You hit the nail on the head with the pastoral part of the reaction to all of this. One of the things that I've noticed is I think the collective Unitarian Universalism has not been very good in general at helping people sit with discomfort. Mm-hmm. It's all about, I think Lena Gardner, one of the lines in one of her blog posts was, we comfort the comfortable and neglect the afflicted. So mm-hmm. we are just mm-hmm. not a good people at sitting with discomfort at all. Because had we been, if that had been part of our humility, part of our spiritual practice all since 61, then we would have a place for pastoral responding in a pastoral way to white supremacy. And that's kind of part of next steps, is how do we turn this into pastorally sitting with people I mean, A, decenter, it's not about you. It isn't, it's like you said, it's not to you, it's about you, but not, it really isn't. It's that this is a reality we're living with. And like you, and I loved what you said. It's, you know, people ask me all the time, like, why are you, why? Like, I have a Jewish neighbor who said to me, enough with this already. She's like, you know, when I tell her another story about another email I get of somebody, you know, totally mad at me over, she said, enough with this already, you know, why? And I said, no, it's actually pretty, you know, because when it's great, right?
Yeah.
So I appreciated that.
Yeah, no, and I like, and I, something about what you said was that, oh, I think liberal progressive ethic, right, is that everything is okay. And we are, that's what it is. It's, you are liberating people from pain, but that's not liberal. And that's why liberalism and liberation are two different things, because liberation, I say people, I'm not a liberal, I'm a liberationist, because a liberationist understands that we are moving from bondage to freedom, not from like, you know, I don't know. I don't even know what liberalism is really. It's just not from this like constraint, I don't know, to freedom. I don't know. It's just a weird thing. Like liberalism is the absence of pain. Liberation is the absence of slavery. There are two different things altogether. And this is a liberal tradition, not a liberationist tradition. So
this has been a fabulous hour. Thank you so much, Michael Crumpler, for being here and dropping some wisdom on us. And it was so good getting to know you. And I look forward to getting to know you more in the future. I want to let everyone know next week, Blue, Black Lives of UU, will be here on The View. We are a month away from General Assembly. I think there will be a few things to talk about. Any last words from our hosts or guests?
I feel Thank like you. We need another hour of liberation theology, liberal feel-good stuff that really hasn't served us well, frankly. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me on. This has been a lot different than I expected, actually, in a good way. It's a great conversation. I feel liberated. So thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for being here. And we will see you next week on The View.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.